Thanks, Tom. Is that too loud? Is that better? Okay. I think it turned off. No, it's on. Okay. So today my talk's how a changing stratosphere is going to affect high latitude climate, or how we think it's going to affect high latitude climate. And the first thing I want to say is that I just got back 6 or 7 weeks ago from Britain, and I spent the year at Reading. And there's a picture of the house I lived in. We had the upper floor of this house. And it turns out that our landlord was an interesting guy. Actually, the owner of the house is an interesting guy. Does anybody recognize him?
Simon Cowell.
No, it's not Simon Cowell.
Uri Geller.
Yeah. So the psychic spoonbender owned our house. And so he actually had us with a bunch of other people over his house. And he demonstrated this spoon bending, where he would use his mind to bend metal. And I was 4 feet from him, and I could not figure out how he did it. He'd hold the spoon, and he'd manipulate it and stuff, and the thing would, and then he'd show it was bent. And I couldn't figure out when he did it, but so he's a really great magician, a very charismatic guy. Anyway, so that period's over. I'm back in the U.S., near Seattle, actually in Redmond, home of Microsoft, that couldn't play my PowerPoint presentation. So that's why I'm using my own computer. So first, I'm going to talk a broad overview of many different things today. The first thing I'll talk about is I'm going to show you some evidence that stratospheric changes affect high-latitude northern climate. I'm going to show that evidence that ozone loss in the southern hemisphere polar regions has affected Antarctic climate. Then I'll talk some about projections of future climate. If we sort of understand how the stratosphere can affect high-latitude climate in both hemispheres, what is going to happen to the stratospheric climate and what is going to happen to the surface climate as a result of stratospheric changes. Then I'm going to diverge a little bit to suggesting some diagnostics for climate models. And the data simulation people may think of ways that these diagnostics could be used to help them in data simulation. And there's sort of an overall theme on this talk of how confident are we in these projections of future climate when a lot of the models are not taking into account the processes that we know or we expect to know are important. So I'm going to talk a fair bit today about annular modes. So I'm going to do a little bit of introduction of annular modes. And in 1998, Thompson and Wallace came out with this paper in GRL introducing this Arctic oscillation or northern annular mode, whatever you want to call it. And it's simply the leading empirical orthogonal function of low-frequency variability, and they did it at the surface. So if you had a bunch of weather maps of monthly means, say December, January, and February, for many years, you'd have this stack of maps. You take out the climatology, and then you have anomalies, a stack of anomaly maps. And the leading ERF is simply the pattern that accounts for the most variability in that data. So that's the simple idea. But what you can do is once you have that pattern, you can actually multiply, project daily data onto that pattern. You can get an index. So you can get a daily index of what the northern annular mode or the Arctic oscillation is doing. And what I tried back in 98 was to do that at multiple levels. So I got an index of the NAM at 1,000 hectopascals, but I also got the index higher up. And in this diagram, what I'm showing is 1,000 up to, here's 1 hectopascal. It's blended. I use blended data sets to do this, anything. But what's really nice is that in the stratosphere, the sign of the northern annular mode tells you whether there are weak winds or strong winds. And it's really just a measure of the strength of the polar vortex in the stratosphere. So a negative index means weak winds, weak polar vortex. Positive index means strong winds, strong polar vortex. So it's a nice shorthand in the stratosphere. So confined to the stratosphere, you have your hands on a lot of information if you just know the annular mode index. The stratospheric variability is fairly simple. But the troposphere, you see, looks kind of disconnected from the stratosphere. The time scale is much shorter. Stratosphere, the time scale is a couple of months. And this year happens to have had 2 major warmings. So this is a major warming, and this is another one here. So in this annular mode index, these stratospheric events stand out really well. In the troposphere, there seems to be no connection or even the opposite connection during this warming. And then in the second one, it seems like the warming just penetrated right to the surface. So what I tried doing was to composite events that looked like this and the opposite, these strong cold vortex events. And what I did is I picked a level of 10 hectopascals to try to composite. I wanted it nowhere near the troposphere, so I couldn't be criticized for saying the troposphere was doing these things. So I picked 10 hectopascals and said, I'm just going to look for these strong red events and strong blue events at 10 hectopascals, and then just average them together and make two composites, a red composite and a blue composite. So I did that, and this happens to be, it's 18 weak vortex events, but they're 18 sudden warmings is what it really is. And you can see that these events tend to propagate down to the surface. So there's actually a time delay from when the event happens in the stratosphere to when it's happening at the surface. When I did the composite, I figured I would see that. I wasn't sure what I would see out here, but what surprised me was the time scale is really long. It's a couple of months that the lowermost stratosphere is disturbed. And during that time, the troposphere tends to be disturbed, has to have the same sign of disturbance. So you got this long time scale, you know, much longer than the tropospheric time scales. You might be lucky to get a week or two in the troposphere. And you've got a couple of months. And during that couple of months, the Arctic Oscillation, or NAM index, tends to be of the same sign as it is in the stratosphere. And when I did the blue composite, the strong vortex events, I saw essentially the same thing. But calculating this is enough work that people don't really want to do it. You have to go in with monthly mean data of let's say in a latitude longitude grid and get monthly means, do your ELF calculation. Then you have to have daily anomalies, project the daily anomalies from your whole data set at every different level onto this pattern and get this index. So the calculation is maybe a bit fiddly to do, and people tend not to want to do it. And especially modelers don't want to output three-dimensional geopotential height fields every day for all their model runs. So people tend not to do it. So I'm going to come back to this again toward the end of my talk and show you a simplified way of getting at this same information that's almost the same and I think is going to be useful. So when I looked at these, I thought, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to not pay attention to these variations within this window because these really depend on exactly what events went into the composite. And I thought, well, I'm going to just average days 0 to 60 and see what happens. What's going on at the surface in days 0 to 60 here and days 0 to 60 here? And there's a pretty good indication that this is going to be a negative NAM index and this is going to be a positive NAM index. So I did that. And here are PDFs of the AO index at the surface. And the gray curve is the climatological curve. And this is December, January, February, March, April. But it's not critical what months I'm using. So for the strong vortex events, we get the blue curve. And the weak vortex events, we get the red curve. And so there's a pretty big shift in the mean. But I think what's more important, especially for high latitude climate, is if you look out at the extremes, like minus 2 sigma, you know, you look at the probability of, in a strong after strong vortex event, of getting a minus 2 sigma event, it's not very large, but it's much larger after a weak vortex event. So this suggests that these sudden warmings are the opposite, the strong vortex events, are affecting the Arctic oscillation of the surface, which I'll show you has significant effects on surface climate. So I also looked at storm tracks, and for this slide, just pay attention to the thick red and blue are the average storm tracks, the average tracks of surface low pressure systems during these 60-day periods following these stratospheric events. And you can see the storm tracks have shifted, and these storm tracks are right up here at high latitudes over Europe. And even out over the Pacific Ocean, there's a pretty big shift. Not any change across near Japan, but as you get to the U.S., the storms are tracking in different places. So there's a pretty big and a significant difference in where those storms are tracking. So I did a simple thing. I just averaged the surface pressure anomalies during the weak vortex regimes and the strong vortex regimes. And what's remarkable, I think, in these two patterns are they both look like the Arctic oscillation pattern. So if you compare this to like Thompson and Wallace's Arctic oscillation, this is basically what you see, a vortex anomaly of one sign, and then this opposite lobe over the Atlantic. And you can quibble about that this isn't quite right over here, but they're actually pretty close. So what's going on? The stratosphere, those strong and weak vortex events in the NAM index, which is a really good representation of that, couples downward, and this is the pattern you see at the surface, which is also the NAM index. So I'm not really sure why, but the NAM index seems to be just a really good indicator of that stratosphere-troposphere coupling. It would be hard to come up with something better representation of what's going on at the surface when this is the actual impact. And the index I basically happened upon, it looks just like this. So I'll interject a little bit with some possible dynamical mechanisms. And it's the mechanism of how these events come down from the stratosphere and affect surface climate are not really well understood. But there have been some interesting paper. Thompson, Furtado, and Shepard last year published a nice paper about direct effects of stratospheric wave driving, wave drag, EP flux divergence, and stratospheric temperature anomalies, and how they and they demonstrated that quantitatively you could actually get the effects you're seeing that I just showed you from that simple mechanism. And then there are indirect effects involving waves, papers on baroclinic waves and life cycles being affected by stratospheric changes, planetary scale waves being affected. You've got long wavelengths in the vertical, and if you change the stratosphere, you have to change those planetary waves. Other things, wave reflection in the stratosphere is another possibility, at least at some times. But these things are not completely understood. And next month, we're having an AGU Chapman conference in Santorini in Greece, and we're trying to work out what, make more progress on in this topic and try to understand it better. So I said before I would talk a little bit about what happens with to surface climate. And what I'm going to do is confine my discussion a little bit to if the AO index at the surface changes. And again, Thompson and Wallace had this nice paper in Science in 2001, in which what they did is they took days that had a high NAM index, I think it was greater than plus one sigma, and they composited them together. And then they took all the days during winter that had a low NAM index, less than minus one, and they composited those together. And so Dave just made these weather maps of the average weather during high NAM index days and low NAM index days. And if you're over, say, the UK, during high NAM index days, you've got strong westerlies. Low NAM index days, you've got weak easterlies. The contour interval in this diagram is 5 degrees C. So small shifts are making pretty big differences in the weather. And they went on to discuss precipitation and other things and wind. And so that there, if you could know what the AO index was going to do, you'd have a lot of information on what the weather's going to be like, especially over Europe and to some extent over the United States. And they also discussed frequency of extreme events in this paper. So at the high latitudes, this is basically the same type diagram just viewed from the pole. So the high NAM index days, the low NAM index days, and over the Arctic, you're getting tremendously different winds, which will affect, of course, sea ice movement. Temperature contours don't look all that different over the pole, but they are somewhat different, especially over northern Europe. And they did a nice diagram. It's a little complicated to say what it is, but they came up with a ratio of the frequency of occurrence of cold events, and they had a special definition of what a cold event is. There's like minus 1.5 sigma or anything, or something like that. But anyway, what this diagram is the ratio of the frequency of occurrence of cold events between high NAM index and low NAM index days. And these contours, the first contour is 2 times, 3 times, 4 times, 6 times. So there are really big differences in the likelihood of cold events. And at high latitudes is where you're getting the greatest effect across Greenland, somewhat over North America, but especially over northern Europe. You're getting big differences in how likely these cold events are to occur in winter. And they went on to show lots of other statistics about likelihood of snowfall in Japan and Seattle and things like that. So this, if you can understand what the NAM index is doing, you actually have a pretty good handle on not just the mean, but on these extreme events. So Dave Thompson keeps coming up over and over again, but he's going to come up in this too, this Southern Hemisphere climate response to ozone depletion. So we all know that the ozone hole for the beginning, say, in the 70s or so, the ozone has been depleted, which causes a relative cooling over the southern hemisphere polar cap in October, November, December type time frame. And so Dave Thompson, Nathan Gillett, and Susan Salmon had a couple of papers. They used observations and a model. And Nathan ran a GCM. And what he did is he tried to simulate the observations, which I'll show you in a moment, by using only the observed ozone loss in the southern hemisphere and see what does the model show as far as changes to the stratosphere, changes to the surface, driven not by greenhouse gas changes, but only by the observed ozone changes. So what he's doing is he's looking at ozone loss, and this is a nice diagram from the ozone assessment. Actually, it's repeated twice in two ozone assessments, but anyway, it shows what typical ozone was like October averages 1962 to 71, and then when ozone is depleted, you're basically just taking out the ozone over the polar cap, and it's essentially down to zero in a pretty big layer. So what effect does that have in the stratosphere and on the surface? So the observations, they kind of had an odd metric for this. If this is a 30-year linear trend in geopotential height, and we've got July, August, September, November, December here, and pressure is going up 50, 30 hectopascals. So essentially, if geopotential heights are dropping, you get these dashed lines here. So during the October, November, December time frame, there's cooling, which is shown as the temperature trend down here, but it's lowering geopotential heights. But they also saw that it comes right down to the surface and lasts into summer. Here's December, January, February. When Nathan ran the model, it's quite remarkable that it really does look like the observations. You've got the same kind of similar contours in the stratosphere, and this is the effect coming down to the surface. And since this publication in 2003, Nathan and his colleagues at University of East Anglia have done quite a bit of work trying to understand what's going on here. And I think they're pretty close. But the signature seems to be robust, and it seems to be a rather difficult to understand radiative effect of the ozone loss. The ozone loss actually lasts well into December, January, February. And they were trying to understand exactly how the surface is affected. But that result seems to be robust, that it does. So if you look at the observations at linear trends in geopotential height in the mid-troposphere in the southern hemisphere, you get this nice southern annular mode pattern. And surface air temperature, the vectors are winds, so a cooling over Antarctica and a warming over the Antarctic Peninsula and over South America. When Nathan ran the model, he got essentially the same thing. I think this is a pretty impressive result. And even surface temperatures look pretty much the same. He's got a little less warming here, but basically the same sign. And so for driving the model only with observed ozone changes, I found this result to be pretty impressive and really, really backed up the observations. So I'm going to show you a variety of things in the next several slides having to do with projections of future climate. So we're in a time when greenhouse gases are increasing, and they will be increasing even faster. But we have this curious thing where we've had ozone loss, but now ozone is beginning to recover. So instead of having both ozone loss occurring at the same time the greenhouse gases are increasing, the greenhouse gases will continue doing what they're doing, continue to increase, but the ozone layer will start to recover. So some of these studies, like studying greenhouse gas effects, are run with these IPCC type models, which on the whole don't have very good stratospheres. But the ozone recovery studies are done with these chemistry climate models. And they both have strengths and weaknesses. And we're not at the stage yet where one model can really do it all. So my overall interpretation of this is that there's a lot of uncertainty in what's going to be happening. So here's from the IPCC report, what's happened to the NAM index, the Arctic Oscillation Index, over the past 100-plus years. People like to look at this trend. They like to begin around 1960, which is conveniently a low point here, and then look at this trend. But if you look at it overall, you've had a downward trend for 70 years or so. A lot a lot of this trend has gone away in recent years, but still there's more positive trend here. And the IPCC models are projecting a positive trend in the NAM index. But again, they're not really representing what's going on in the stratosphere. So at least sometimes of the year, that might not be true. So here are the different scenarios for increasing greenhouse gases. And even if you have the most conservative one, we're still going to be having greenhouse gases increasing by quite a bit. This is a cartoon out of the latest ozone assessment. I'll just confine my discussion to these two panels. The ozone-depleting substances have already peaked and are beginning to recover as a result of the Montreal Protocol. And so this black band represents more or less the uncertainty in a schematic way. And then ozone, we're more or less at the low point for ozone, and then it's expected to be recovering over time. But there's a lot of uncertainty out here getting toward 2100 of what the ozone layer is going to be doing. So the chemistry climate models used for the ozone assessment are really the basis for looking at these things. So we've got ozone recovery versus increasing greenhouse gases. So we see ozone-depleting substances are already decreasing. Ozone abundances will be increasing if they're not already, and it's geographically dependent with the southern hemisphere somewhat delayed. But greenhouse gases increase. And an overall conclusion in the ozone assessment is that ozone recovery is not going to be a simple reversal of ozone depletion because the climate's changing. You can't go back to where we were before. And the model results don't agree in exact detail, but they're all showing the same thing, that because climate's going to be changing, we're not going to be returning to the same conditions we were before. So here's a slide I was given by Eugene Cordero, IPCC altitude of the model tops. And I think the people here, at least for the data simulation people, want their model tops somewhere up here maybe. But you're looking at these IPCC projections with model lids, a lot of them around 10 hectopascals, 30 kilometers. So most of these models aren't any good at all about simulating stratospheric effects. So they just don't have that in there. And their ability to simulate, they're not really simulating ozone chemistry. They have different scenarios plugged into them about ozone recovery or not. So there's really a lot of uncertainty in those IPCC models as to, they can't really simulate stratospheric effects. Nevertheless, they still have these projections. And this is IPCC's Arctic temperature change over the polar cap. And this is 2080 to 99 minus 1980 to 99. So it's a 100-year trend, essentially, in polar cap temperature. And the models that they ran are showing that in winter, you're getting a very big increase in temperature, 7 degrees, and even in summer, a couple of degrees. But these temperatures are really crucial for sea ice formation and melt. So if we're getting warmer temperatures here, we're melting the ice. If we're getting warmer temperatures here, we're not forming the ice as well as we were before. So the question in my mind is, in winter and spring, in this period, how is the stratosphere going to affect high latitude climate? This is in the Arctic. And it's really, at this point, pretty uncertain. But it would presumably be affecting this temperature change over the Arctic. So the question is very simple. How will the stratosphere change? And we're not sure. This is a diagram from a paper just published, Eyring et al. And it's a measure of polar cap temperatures. And I'll first start with the global temperatures. All the models are showing the global stratosphere. Actually, I forgot which level this is. Ted, do you know which level? Oh, yeah, 50 hectopascals. Thanks. Anyway, so globally, if you average the global average, the stratosphere is cooling from increasing greenhouse gases. But if we look up here at 60 to 90 north in winter, there isn't really, in these models, much of a clear trend. It's certainly not decreasing like this. And there are only a few models running out to 2100, but they're actually, the few models that do are actually showing perhaps an increase in temperature. But not all these models are great at stratospheric simulation. So Spark, and Paul Kushner is leading a very nice project called DynVar, which he wants to look at a lot of models that are good at simulating the stratosphere and trying to understand how the stratosphere will change. Because if we don't know how the stratosphere is going to change, we have no hope of predicting effects on surface climate. So how the stratospheric change affects surface climate depends on two things. One is trends in the strength of the polar vortex, essentially trends in the NAM index, but also variability of the polar vortex. It makes a difference whether you're having lots of sudden warmings, lots of cold vortex events, and lots of variability. Those are the things that feed back down to the troposphere and cause these long-lasting anomalies. So the question, how will the troposphere be affected? And I'll go back to this NAM index idea. And I'll first describe, this is a study by Warwick Norton done in 2003. And briefly, he ran a GCM, his control run, and he looked at the autocorrelation of the daily surface AO index. So it drops off something like this, has a shoulder out here 20-25 days. He damped the stratosphere artificially, so it really didn't have warmings, didn't have a lot of variability. And when he did that, the variability in the troposphere at the surface dropped off. So all he did was he tweaked the stratosphere. He took away that variability in the stratosphere, and it affected how long these anomalies last in the troposphere. So while he was working on this, I didn't know about it, but I was doing this, basically the same thing with data. And so I want to talk a little bit, how can we assess stratosphere-troposphere coupling in data or in models? I've done it in data, but I think what we really need to be doing is looking at how well these models simulate stratosphere-troposphere coupling. So this is my version of the time scale of the NAM index. And what I did is I did essentially what Warwick did, but I just defined an E-folding time scale. And that time scale varies as a function of time of year, month, and also in the vertical. So Warwick was looking at the average of December, January, February, and I'm looking at the whole year and looking at things. So what I see is it's about the time scale of the NAM variability is about a week, and so you get to winter, and then it's 2 weeks or more. If you look in the stratosphere, the time scale is much longer. It's roughly a month during winter. But it's curious that the long time scale in the stratosphere aligns with this longest time scale to surface. So I was looking at that thinking, I suspect the stratosphere is having something to do with this, but I couldn't really show it. And then it dawned on me what I should do is look at the southern hemisphere. The southern hemisphere, if I go to the southern hemisphere, what am I going to see? So what I did is I looked at the southern annular mode time scale, and I found it wasn't in winter we have a long time scale in the southern hemisphere. It's not July, August time frame. There's really nothing there. The long time scale of the southern annular mode is November, December. So what's going on at that time? Well, that's the time of the southern hemisphere, the breakdown of the vortex in the southern hemisphere. So I looked at the variance of the southern annular mode, and it's a maximum October, November, December, and in the lowermost stratosphere, this is the time, November, December, it's the same time as when the stratosphere is more variable in the lowermost part, just above the tropopause, is when you get the long time scale of southern annular mode. So you see the two hemispheres are basically doing the same thing. And I want to know, do we see this kind of thing in models? But when I was at Reading in a study group, we were discussing a paper by Gerber et al. And what they were doing is instead of using a two-dimensional Latlon annular mode index, they did an annular mode index based on zonal mean geopotential. And that struck a note with me because I'd published a paper on that in 2001 just at the surface. So this is from my paper in 2001. The dashed line and the solid line represent the official NAM index, and the solid one is my zonally average NAM index. Essentially, the patterns end up being very similar. The time series are very similar. So I thought, why don't I just do the one-dimensional NAM index? I just need zonally average data, and I'll see how that compares to the full two-dimensional NAM index. So if I do the variance of the 2D NAM for the northern hemisphere, this is sort of the benchmark I'm looking for. And when I look at I did the 1D version, which by the way takes 5 minutes on my laptop to do this. This is 5 hours. And essentially in the stratosphere, they're just identical. And as you get into the troposphere, They're very similar, except in late winter, which is a curiosity. There's something that's going on that involves more than the zonal mean that's causing this variability here. But this, I also found that this 1D NAM index is actually really robust in that it's consistent from level to level, which is not true of the usual NAM index. So I think there's some advantages to it. We just need no limitations. And I did the time scale. This is the benchmark I showed you before. And if I do the 1D NAM time scale, we still get the same effect. We get this midwinter maximum in the time scale. It doesn't look quite the same as this. But we can do this one easily for models as long as we have daily zonally averaged geopotential. This one requires two-dimensional fields, which the modelers are very reluctant to put out.
And really, there's no justification for a 2D NAM index either. I mean, it's no more dynamical than a 1D.
No, they're just statistical patterns. So they're pretty close, but I've got a paper almost ready to submit on this right now, and I'm going to be arguing the point that we should be looking at this, because once you have that NAM index, then you can do the time scale diagnostics, the variability diagnostics, you can do the downward propagation of events and everything. You can look at all these things in models, which is what we should be doing. So Warwick Norton sent me 50-year output from a model. It's called HiGEM. And he didn't actually send me any information about the details of the model run. And there are many different configurations. So I'm sorry, I can't tell you exactly what configuration it was. But this is the 1D NAM timescale. This is observational data from ECMWF. And this is Warwick's HiGEM model. So you see, broadly, it's pretty similar. You know, I wouldn't pay too much attention to this, because it's just long-lasting anomalies in the summer. But he's got the winter maxima aligned with January, February, a long time scale. So it actually looks pretty, the HiGEM model looks pretty good. And I also looked at variance of HiGEM. This seems curious. The HiGEM model seems to have a lot of variance toward the end of winter, whereas the atmosphere really has variability, say, maximum in January. So, but these are the kind of things, like once you run a model, or you compare models, you can look at these things and say, what's going on? Like if the model has its most variability in March or April, maybe all it's doing is final warmings. So I think, and these kind of diagnostics are really easy to do once you have that index. So the future of the stratosphere. To summarize, increasing greenhouse gases are going to cool the stratosphere overall, but ozone recovery is going to reverse the Southern Hemisphere trends that the Gillett-Thompson-Solomon work was showing. So the stratospheric NAM index, it's not clear what would happen. It's going to depend on relative cooling of the polar cap. And I think it's fair to say that most, but not all models, are showing a warmer, weaker Northern Hemisphere vortex in winter and spring. And that was not true. Back in 99, Drew Schindel had a paper. It was a big splash that the northern annular mode was going to go to a positive trend, and his model was showing it was always consistent. Everyone was agreeing. Now the models are showing the opposite on the most part. There's still some showing the opposite trend. So in my mind, there's a lot of uncertainty as to what's going to happen. To get that NAM trend right and get the stratosphere-troposphere coupling right, you've got to get the troposphere right. And then you've got to get coupling to the stratosphere wave propagation right, and the feedback, the dynamical coupling, back down to the troposphere right. And that seems to be a lot to ask of models. And so how can we be sure that the models are really right and they're not just agreeing, even if they do agree? So to summarize, ozone-producing substances are forcing trends with the opposite of what they were up until about 2000. So you've got the opposite effect going on, in contrast to greenhouse gas forcing. So the chemistry climate models are predicting that cooling stratosphere will accelerate ozone recovery, which is kind of an interesting result. So we've actually got increasing greenhouse gases helping the ozone layer to recover, and maybe make a super recovery later in the century. But the feedbacks to high-latitude surface climate are uncertain, simply because we don't really know what the stratosphere is going to be doing. And even if we did know, it gets tricky to get that coupling right. We've got to have more confidence in the models. And so diagnostics of stratosphere troposphere coupling in climate models and seasonal prediction models, chemistry climate models, I think those kind of diagnostics are something that's pretty easy to do and something that we really should be looking at. And I want to thank my sponsors, listed across the bottom here for this research. Now, I want to thank Saroja and Ted for organizing such a well-done meeting. And it's not just the science. They were dedicated into seeing that our social events were a big success, too. Thank you.